Hi, Becca.
Hi, Stephen. How's it going? You beat me this time.
I did. Yeah, yeah. You gotta go for that brass ring.
Yeah, catch up on the podcast if you haven't tuned in this week and you'll
By
get
the way,
that joke.
When I say go for the brass ring, do you know what that means?
I don't know what that means.
Oh, that's okay. But have you heard the term before? You gotta go
I've
for
heard
the,
you say it, yeah.
You've heard
yeah.
me say it?
You say it? Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I'm giving you 19th century entertainment references. Go for the brass ring or reach for the brass ring is that merry-go-rounds used to have an additional game.
Oh.
Is that you'd be on the merry-go-round, but on there'd be a little arm on the outside of the merry-go-round on a post, and there'd be a little rack, and on the rack were a series of brass rings. And the rack had a little roll to it. So one, the brass rings would roll down. So one of them would be at the end of the little rack, and you could stick your finger through it and pull it off
oh.
a little spring system. And then the next brass ring would roll down. And it was, will you dare, as you go around, to lean off your horse like a trick rider
yeah.
and reach out and grab that brass ring?
Oh, cool.
So it's putting a little extra effort in, taking a little risk.
Yeah.
But what you get is the brass ring. And I think it was sort of thing like you turned in the brass ring for like a Cupid doll or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, and you like you reach for the brass ring so you could get your girl who's riding on the next horse over. You could get her, you know,
yeah.
that was it. Reach for
what
the brass
happened?
Ring.
Why are they not around anymore? Too many
probably insurance.
Bloody noses or something.
Probably insurance.
Yeah,
people
yeah.
fell off.
Do you know I love merry-go-rounds? It's a big thing about me. I love a good merry-go-round.
Wow.
I have this idea that I'm trying to do where I'm trying to create. I'm not an influencer by any means, but I think it'd
yes,
be really
you are.
Funny.
Little, you're by some means you're an influencer.
To be a merry-go-round influencer and the
oh,
account
you go,
would be
you go to merry-go
around the world.
And oh, merry-go
around the world. And that
wow.
there's a lot of beautiful old merry-go-rounds around.
There's one in Central Park. The nice one in Central Park.
The
there's
one in
Brooklyn.
Good one in Brooklyn. There's my favorite merry-go-round in the world is on West Riverside Park, uptown.
Oh, yeah.
I did a tip-to-tip where I went from the top tip of Manhattan to the bottom tip, and I encountered it by chance. But there's
that must have been wild for you to just come around the corner and see a merry-go-round.
To see a merry-go-round, and yet there she was. But this is an
Tell
amazing
me about
merry-go-round.
It. What do you love about it?
This artist in New York, I'm forgetting his name right now, and I apologize for that. I'll pull it in the description. But he did a lot of art for Sesame Street, and he was asked by the city of New York to create a merry-go-round for this park that they were building. And he would go into public schools in Harlem and say, oh, we're going to make a merry-go-round together. You're going to doodle me your, like, dream merry-go-round animal that you want to ride. And so these little kids, like kindergarten, first grade,
wow.
drew these goofy little doodles of animals. Like, you know those,
yeah, yeah.
seeing like the way a kid draws a horse,
yes.
it's just a glob with a smiley face on
yeah.
it. And then he created those perfectly to become plexiglass sculptures that you can then ride. And then there's a little, like, the signature of the kid is, like, inscribed in the wood beneath it. And there's
oh.
a little picture of what the original doodle was. And all the kids who got a merry-go-round creature on the merry-go-round has like a lifetime pass to ride it whenever. It's so cool. I'll show you pictures later.
How old is it?
It's from the 90s, I think, so it's
wow.
not that
These
old.
These kids could be...
Yeah.
Have kids of their own.
Yeah. No, definitely.
Wow.
But it's a really beautiful thing.
That's
and
lovely.
A great mix of, you know, art, you know, children of the city and the government coming together to make something fun.
Do you know, like, history of merry-go-rounds or anything like that? Like,
well, I'm learning now the brass ring I got. Now I know a little bit more, but
wow.
I don't know that much of the history
merry-go-round
of
horses, like... Sometimes you'll see them in an antique store or something, just like an old merry-go-round horse with the pole still sticking through it, like people use as like a end table or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
They often have a like a frantic look on their faces, like
yeah.
a kind of like a scary, like eyes rolled back, like mouth open, like horses like galloping for mad like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder if there was ever a point
sometimes
where
sometimes they
real
go up and down. Sometimes they
certain...
go up and down, and sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
yeah.
I like the up and down ones.
The posting ones. The posting ones are nice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah. highly recommend that.
Yeah.
That piece of New York history, go up to see the merry-go-round sometime. But anyways, we have a little game that we like to play here on the Late Show Pod Show that I call Late Show Vocab.
Yes.
Which is that Stephen and a lot of people on the show, we develop a shorthand. We have a lot of sayings that we are like sort of insider lingo that we say all the time, but then when I think about it, I'm not sure what some of it means. They have great backstories,
mm-hmm.
and I like asking Stephen what they mean. And this, today,
Hopefully I will know the meaning of this.
This is a phrase you say all the time, and I don't know the backstory of it, or even really what it means.
Okay.
The Knack. I know the band, The Knack, but...
The Knack, obviously My Sharona,
mm-hmm,
being
of
their
course.
Big hit. I don't know why I started doing it here, But on when I'm reading the intros in rehearsal, I go through the entire script, and you know, some of it is quite meaningful. I have to understand what the setups are. Did I really understand the news story that we're making our jokes about that day? Does this punchline work? What's the order? There's a lot of decisions to be made about on the fly, and I'm giving notes on the fly, and I'm asking questions, and I'm hitting research. I'm asking graphics. I'm questioning what our take is. Like, is that really what we want to say? Is that what are we? What's that about, that joke? And but then I have to read everything that's in the prompter just to make sure everything's properly in the prompter. And I have to read the guest intros. And when we get to the band, if there's a band, I tend to not say the name of the band. I tend to say, you know, making their late night debut with the album that last night won 2 Grammys. You know, please welcome The Knack. Because The Knack were big when I was young.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one reason. And another reason is when I was young and on tour with Second City, there was a guy named Scott Allman. And Scott Allman knew a lot about a lot of bands, a lot of obscure bands, but also just a lot of general bands. And we were doing a newspaper quiz one day about like great hits of the 70s or something like that. I forgot what it was. And there was some really difficult trivia question as we were on. You know, they burn a lot of time in the van looking for a lot. This is before the internet, friends.
Uh-huh.
This is before cell phones, friends.
Yeah.
You know, so it was books and magazines and newspapers. And he was very confident that he had the answer to whoever, what the answer to this band was. And he reached forward and he goes, no, wait. And he reaches his fist forward, like does that fist pump thing where you pull your fist down, like you're like clenched. And he goes, The Knack. And it could not have been not The Knack more. It was like Stevie Wonder or something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Who wrote Do I Do, you know? The Knack. And we made so much fun of his commitment that it was The Knack.
Yeah.
That it never left me.
Mm-hmm.
And the people, one person was in the car, Paul Dinella, one of the producers here, he was in the car, the van, when that happened. And he could confirm this. I don't know if you ever do fact checking on these podcasts, but he can confirm that's where The Knack comes from.
Okay, cool. Great and backstory.
Best to you, Scott Allman, wherever you may roam these days. And he... Scott also had a really good way. He'd shut down anyone else's idea about what an answer for something would be. He would go, no, no, no. He had this very way of talking like this.
Oh, Chicago.
No, Chicago. No, no, no. So he's like, no, 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 I got it. The Knack. And it was not The Knack. And so in my mind, why waste my time saying, you know, Sigur Rós, whatever, like whoever the band is, you know, Charlie XCX. No, The Knack.
Yeah,
every band to me. Every band who's ever come on this show, in my mind, is The Knack.
Awesome. Yeah.
Except The Knack, who we've never had on.
Who we've never had on.
And I don't think they're all still with us, unfortunately.
No, 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 no.
It's too bad.
Okay, great story. And you do that—
It's an okay story.
You do that with, well, this is a little bit different, but in the script, the writers are instructed to never write, I'm your host, Stephen Colbert.
Right.
The script always says, I'm Stephen Colbert.
Right.
Why is that?
I don't know. But in the script,
but you always say.
In the script, in the prompter and on the script, I always said, welcome to The Late Show. I'm Stephen Colbert. And I think the very first night, maybe I went, welcome to The Late Show. I'm your host, Stephen Colbert. But it said, I'm Stephen Colbert. And after that, I was like, oh, okay, I'll just say I'm your host, Stephen Colbert, because I like the formality. I like something so, in a way, comedy is essentially low rent.
Mm.
And there's something very... a little formal about welcome to The Late Show. I'm your host, Stephen Colbert. And instead of I'm Stephen Colbert, I'm your host, Stephen Colbert. Much more like a maitre d', like I'm taking you to a nice table or something like that. Because of that, or like welcome to the party, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And because I think of it as like welcoming people to a party. And I don't know. I get stuck in my head that certain things become ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to me that it never say I'm your host, Stephen Colbert in the prompter. That it only say I'm Stephen Colbert. And then I will add your host. And there's some – it's some handshake I have with the script that I don't have to say every word that's up there. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to say exactly the way that's in the prompter. And so that – I start off the show knowing that I know something the audience doesn't know about me reading the script, is that I'm not entirely reading the script. I'm reading an impression of the script.
Totally. Yeah, that's beautiful. I love that. I always love that.
But it's funny you picked up on – like, have I said that out loud?
I look at the script every single day. It's my job. And I also listen to the taping every single day. And I'm just – this does not match up.
No, it never matches up.
There was one day when we did write, "I'm your host, Stephen Colbert," and you said, "Delete that." You said, "They can't say that." I remember that really specifically. And I think you gave a similar reason to it, maybe not so in depth. But you were just like, "I like to remind myself to add that."
It's up to me to not be a slave to the prompter. That, like, the prompter and I are having this conversation.
Yeah.
I'm not – and it's not dictating it to me.
Yeah.
I mean, largely, but not –
Yeah.
We put a lot of thought into the words.
We do. We do. And you do especially more than anyone else.
And then the important thing is to look like you haven't put a lot of thought into the words.
Yes, exactly. Keep it conversational.
It's very important to say a lot of the script not looking at the camera.
Yeah.
So it doesn't look like you're reading.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And speaking of conversational hosts, you know who we have today on the podcast?
John Oliver.
No, we have the amazing Terry Gross.
Terry Gross.
Terry Gross.
Not for the faint of heart to interview Terry Gross, because you will find yourself being interviewed by Terry Gross.
And she does do that to you.
She does. She interviews me. In the last few minutes of this, it becomes her interviewing me. Oh, Terry, the best.
She's so cool.
She's so great. I admire her so much, and I enjoy, like, first time I went on Terry Gross's show, Fresh Air, I was still at The Daily Show, and I enjoyed the interview so much that I thought, I mean, she kind of gave me the ability to be interviewed by being the first person to really interview me.
Yeah.
Because I went, that's how open you can be with someone. Or that's she set the table for me in an interesting way for every interview after that.
Whoa.
Because she was one of the earliest in-depth interviews that I did.
Mm-hmm.
And that she took interest in me, even though I was a correspondent. I didn't have a project or anything. She just wanted to talk to me, which is fantastic.
Cool.
And you know, when we first came over to do this show, we didn't really know how to do the show. And I thought, well, I'm definitely not going to do Terry Gross until I know exactly what I'm doing and why I'm doing it and what I want to be saying and what my intention is and all that kind of stuff. I'm not going to go talk to Terry now until I really figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And so 9.5 years go by or something, and Evie and I put out our cookbook, Does This Taste Funny? It's still available. You go get it. And I said in the interview, and I said, now, Terry, I don't think I've been on your show since the show started, since the Late Show started. And she said, are you joking? I said, no, have I been on? She goes, you've been on 3 times before. And I guess what that says to me is that, unlike the old show, where it came out of the box exactly as I intended, and it kind of, we built on it, but it came kind of snapped together out of the box. This one, even once we kind of knew what we wanted to do, it's always been changing. I've always been in a relationship with the show of wondering whether there's something else I could do.
Mm.
Is there a different way to interview somebody? Is there something else we could do in the second act? How should cold opens be? What's the handshake with the audience at the top of the monologue? How long should the monologue be? What's the mix of, like, politics and other things?
Yeah.
God, can we possibly get away from Washington today? All those conversations that, like, there are musical guests, comedy guests, variety guests, sketches, all these things. There's, because this is really a variety show more than that other thing was a satire.
Mm-hmm.
This is a variety show. I've constantly been questioning its form.
Yeah. It's so
or
malleable.
My part in the form and what I can add to it.
Yeah.
And so it had actually kind of seemed like me that I hadn't landed on it enough to go talk to Terry about it.
Yeah.
And there's nothing to do with her or my enjoyment of her. It just struck me at that moment, I'm still in my mind 9.5 years in going, what do I want this to be?
Yeah. And that's kind of beautiful. It's been a working progress the whole time, you know?
Yeah. So Terry.
I love Terry. And she also, when she's interviewing someone, you know she read the whole book. You know she watched the whole movie and she's talking to you.
I know, it's infuriating.
All right, so this is Terry Gross. This is an extended interview with her.
More extended than was on the thing?
More extended than was on the thing. Yeah. Wow. It's a great interview. You guys
That's great.
Had a great time. So this is Terry Gross in her leather jacket on the Late Show Pod Show.
Thanks, Becca.
Thanks, Stephen.
Welcome back to the Late Show. Ladies and gentlemen, my next guest has been the award-winning host of NPR's Fresh Air for 50 years. Please welcome back to the Late Show, Terry Gross.
Terry, it's good to see you again.
It's great to see you. I listen to your show all the time.
And I listen to your show all the time, too. You were 24 years old when you started hosting Fresh Air 50 years ago.
There you are. Fantastic.
Do you, I'm asking for a friend, do you recommend doing a show for 50 years?
Well, the good thing about it is longevity.
Sure, yeah.
And I haven't had to move. You know, I've stayed in one place for the 50 years because the show moved. It went from a local show to a national show to more stations. Our staff has evolved over the years, different people, so many great people I've worked with. So
always at WHYY?
I started at the NPR affiliate on the University of Buffalo station.
Oh, wow. This was an affiliate right there.
No, this is Buffalo, where I went to college.
I know, but right there in Buffalo, I mean, right on the college campus.
Yeah, that's where I started.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Did you always want to do radio? Did you always have an affiliation for it?
I loved radio because, you know, I lived in a small apartment in Brooklyn, Sheepshead Bay. I don't hear any applause for Sheepshead Bay. and, you know, I had a small bedroom. It was small with me and my brother and my parents. And the radio was the reach outside. I didn't have a TV in my room. Certainly didn't have a computer. They didn't exist yet. And so I'd put the transistor radio under my pillow at night. Not every night, but frequently. So
to hide it from your parents?
To hide it from my parents. Because it was like bedtime. Right. You know, and that was
what were you listening to?
Well, rock and roll.
Oh, yeah. Leather jacket. Leather. There you go. Do you get recognized by your voice? Because I could pick you out in a minute.
Only in embarrassing situations.
Such as?
Such as early on when I started hosting Fresh Air, I needed to buy a car. And so I went to the Toyota place, and the salesman there said, I had the radio on because I wanted to test the speakers. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, there's a lady on in the afternoon who's really annoying. And I said, oh, that would be me. And he said, oh, I'm never going to sell a car now. I ended up buying it from him. I mean,
wow.
Gave me a decent price. It was conveniently located. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So approximately, I know you have to ballpark it. How many interviews have you done in the last 50 years?
I'm told, I think, that it's somewhere between like 15,000 or 18,000. I didn't count.
Wow. Wow.
And you are one of the most frequent guests on our show.
Oh, really?
Yes, because we love you.
Oh, well, I love being on. The first time I got to be on, I was still on The Daily Show. I didn't even have my own
That's
gig.
That's right.
I couldn't believe I got asked to do. I was so nervous, and I had such a good time.
And we talked about This Day in God.
Yes, we did.
Which
we talked about This Day
feature.
In God, exactly.
And your thoughts about the Catholic Church.
Sure, and sort of the differentiation between the individuation of the American ideal and the homogeny of a Catholic dogma.
You schooled me very well.
Well, what have you learned about people after 15,000 long conversations like that?
A fair amount of artists and writers who I've interviewed were sick a lot during childhood and kind of cooped up at home.
Were you cooped up at home as a child?
No, I felt cooped up, but I wasn't literally cooped up.
Oh, okay.
But I found that a lot of, artists and writers, they're forced to stay home, and they kind of busy themselves writing or watching a lot of TV and realizing, oh, I'd love to act, it's nice to know that because the worst things in your life can have a payoff sometimes if you're really lucky.
Yeah.
Although I don't believe every problem is really a gift. You know, I don't buy that.
You don't buy that.
Yeah, okay. This cancer is making me a better person.
No, I don't buy that either.
Yeah.
I don't buy that either.
I'm sorry I pounded your table.
I won't need it much longer. Now,
and
in
I'm
July...
So sorry about that. I'm gonna
in July,
you.
Republicans in Congress cut $1.1 billion in funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and on Monday... On Monday, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting voted to dissolve. And as someone who's worked in public radio for their whole career, what role did the CPB play in you starting this life?
Huge. When I started at the college station, that was an NPR affiliate. At that time, you had to have, I think, like 5 full-paid staff members in order to qualify for funding. Because there are only 5 full-time paid staff members, there were like about 100 volunteers. And that's how I was able to get started as a volunteer. And on the other end, when our show went from a local show to a national one, financially, it could not possibly have happened without a major grant from the CPB to do all the things that we needed to do. And I think it was worth their investment. I mean, the show has endured. So, yeah, it wouldn't have happened. Thank you. It wouldn't have happened without the CPB.
I was so sorry to hear last April about the death of your husband.
Thank you.
Francis Davis. And about 2 weeks later, you remembered him with a tribute on Fresh Air. Why did you choose to share that with the audience?
A few reasons. One is that he had been a jazz contributor to our show. He'd been a jazz critic on our show, and it was local. And then for the first couple of months, maybe, he was doing it on the national show until he felt like, I'm not really a radio person. I'm really more of a writer. So I felt like he's still part of the Fresh Air family. But I also felt while I was like in that really early stage of grieving that before coming back, I had to explain what I had just been through. And also, I wanted to share a piece of him. So I did it. I didn't say like, we had such a great love. Let me share some of our memories together. It was like, this is what he did. He was a music critic, mostly jazz. So I'm going to play some of the music that he loved and then read some of his writing that reveals something about the music that he loved. And that felt so right to me. And it also gave me not only an opportunity, but an excuse and a deadline to immerse myself in his writing. Some people find their loved ones in their clothes or, you know, special possessions. I find my husband in his books.
It can be hard to look directly at your grief. And was that a way, is that a lens through which it allowed you to look at your grief?
Yeah, and to look fully at him. Because the writing really was him. He didn't write much personally, but it was him. It was his sensibility. It was his language. I fell in love with his writing at about the same time. I fell in love with his writing first. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with him.
In the just 10 months since your husband passed, have there been any old interviews that have come back to you that you have turned to that have special meaning for you now?
Yes. I interviewed Maurice Sendak close to the same time, I think, that you interviewed him. I think you went to his home.
Yeah.
He was no longer mobile. He was no longer to get out of the house. So he had come out with his first children's book in years. Mm-hmm. And I thought, and I had been interviewing him since probably the late 1970s. And I thought, this is a good opportunity to call Maurice and basically just give him a shout and say, congratulations on the new book. But he ended up knowing that he was close to death and really wanting to talk about it. So he just started talking about how he had lost his brother, he lost his 2 best friends, but life was beautiful. He still had Bach to listen to. He still had the trees to look at out the window, and he'll be crying to the grave, you know, because he wanted to live longer. And it was just so beautiful, and he ended the interview by saying, live your life, live your life, live your life. And I've repeated that to myself so many times over the years, including when Francis died, because it was also a way of saying, keep living. You've had this terrible loss. You're still alive, you know, so live it. Feel what you're feeling and make the most of what you have. And that was a great tape loop to have. It's supposed to, oh, no. Yeah.
Well,
And Stephen, I know you've, as a child, you lost your father and two brothers in a plane mm-hmm. crash.
I did, yes.
And I've been thinking about the difference between sudden, unexpected, tragic death like that mm-hmm. and my experience with my husband going through like 5 years mm-hmm. of watching him, because he had emphysema and because he had Parkinson's, watch him slowly just lose inch by inch parts of himself and parts of his ability to live his life. Yeah.
Yeah, people experience grief in many different ways. It affects their lives in different ways, at different times of their lives. How they approach it is so different for each person. There's a commonality to it, which I think is unavoidable to eventually look at it. That's all. Grief is almost something that is outside of you and comes to you. Like, people often use the phrase, like, there's an old phrase, like, visited by grief. And it's as if grief is something that comes and sits with you. And you can decide whether to hold its hand.
I literally felt like I had a visitation after he died. I don't know if you've had dreams like this. Mm-hmm. But I dreamt that he came back and we were walking into the bedroom together because it was bedtime. And I said to him, because I thought it was real. You know, I didn't realize I was dreaming. And I said to him, well, how am I talking to you? You're not here. And then he just vanished. Mm. Kind of like in a movie when somebody like turns into a ghost and they kind of, there's a fade and yes. suddenly they're gone. And I thought, like, did I chase him away by saying, you're not really here? Mm-hmm.
I think that those dreams are not uncommon for people. I know many people have told me stories like that. I've had the same experience myself.
You did?
Oh, yeah. When my mother died, I remember having a very vivid dream. We're at Union Station in D.C., which is where I was born, where she had me. Not in Union Station in D.C. And I walked there, and then she's there with all my brothers and sisters, and there's my mother in her big winter jacket. And she turned around. There she was, the mother I remember my whole life. And I said, Mom, you're alive. I must be dreaming. And she said, oh, good. It's the only way you'll stay awake. And that was it.
Wow. How did you interpret that?
The messages that we get internally from our loved ones are ways for us to be aware of the world and how we feel about it. Or that our dreams tell us things about ourselves that we cannot, in waking life, admit to ourselves.
Right.
We can feel things in our dreams. We can know things about ourselves that we can't know in waking life. And I don't mean prophetically or that there's some astral plane from where these messages come. We talk to ourselves in our dreams, and we wake up to certain feelings in our dreams. That's what I think it meant.
Do you think she was also telling you to live your life, to stay awake?
I think that's a completely valid interpretation, 100%. As a matter of fact, I'm grateful for that interpretation. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Harry. Oh. Thank you so much.
I'm so sorry that you should have been so much.
You can talk on the phone. New episodes of Fresh Air are on NPR every weekday. Terry Gross, everybody. Thank you for listening to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert. Just one more thing. If you want to see more of me, come to The Late Show YouTube channel for more clips and exclusives.